7 of season 12 of Louvre, a Minute to the Daily podcast, where we dig our way through the 1994 film The Shawshank Redemption, one minute at a time. I'm Rob, and joining me once again today is Nick Rehack of the Rabbit Hole Podcasting Network. Welcome back once again, Nick.
Hey, thank you once again for having me back. I appreciate it.
Yeah, just, just TMI.
Fair enough.
So minute 7 begins with the passion escalating and ends with Red standing at attention. So we left things off yesterday. We are in court. Or, sorry, we hear that we're in court, but we're not seeing that we're in court. We're seeing things that are going on that shouldn't happen in the court. So, you know, as the DA is describing everything that happens, we get to see the passionate affair of Glenn Quentin and Andy Dufresne's wife, which I'm trying to remember if they ever say her name. Because I know on IMDb she's just referred to as Andy's wife. It doesn't like say, she's Lucy Dufresne or Lucy McQueen or whatever you want to call it. It's just Andy Dufresne's wife. That's a great way to be known. Oh, what role did you play? Oh, I played Andy Dufresne's wife. No, but what's her name? No, that Andy is Dufresne's wife. Andy Dufresne's wife.
It wasn't like wife number one or mistress number two.
That's true also. But no, you know what? I think wife number one or mistress number two is a more interesting character name than Andy Dufresne's wife. Especially since Andy Dufresne is the main character here. So it's not as if they're saying, oh, well, you know, there's this minor character named Andy Dufresne, so, and you're going to play his wife. Oh, okay, fine. I'll just, you know, be in a little scene where we're having cocktails or something like that. And no, you are in a scene making out passionately with the man that you are cheating on with or the man that you're cheating with on.
Pressed up against the door.
Pressed up against the door. Exactly. Yeah, it always makes me wonder what actors and actresses – you know, think years later when, you know, when their kids are older, like what, you know, these two actors, they're, you know, this movie from 32 years ago. So the assumption is, you know, they have kids that are older now. And like, what do they think when they watch this and they're like, hey, that's mom or that's dad. And what are they doing on screen?
Yeah. Hang on a second. That's not dad. Mom, what are you doing?
That's right. Dad is Andy Dufresne. Yeah. Mom is Andy Dufresne's wife, so yeah, I don't know. Then we get the DA continuing his speech, and he goes, that means that he fired the gun empty and then stopped to reload so that he can shoot each of them again, an extra bullet per lever, and he goes right in the head. Now I'm still a little confused on the fact of how do they know that they never found the gun? So how do they know that he shot with a six shooter? His gun that it was a registered gun was a six shooter. Okay. And it's obviously it's safe to assume that he used his own gun, but what if he didn't? What if he went on the black market and got a gun that had 8 bullets in it? And that's what he used. You know, even when we find out that it's Blatch later on who does this, the same argument can be said because they don't have ballistics matches. They have bullets with fingerprints on him. Without the gun, you can't do ballistics. So it's not as if they can say, oh, this bullet looks similar to the bullet that they use. But okay, so they're 38s, they're 9mm, whatever it is. But you have guns that have 6 bullets, you have guns that have 8 bullets. So it's really funny that later on when, you know, we'll talk about this in a few weeks, where Ellis asks Haywood to tell Andy, you know, you know, if he did it, and he goes, no, lawyer f***ed me. I think Annie's lawyer basically f***ed him here. Because why isn't the lawyer objecting to these things? You know, the DA is showing a gun, and this is not the gun that committed the crime. This is not the gun that everyone, you know, that there's some proof to. He's using that as a prop to say, well, like, this is a replica of the gun that Andy owned. But so what? You know, I know that you and I are neither of us are lawyers, but it just doesn't make any sense.
Well,
maybe it's because we've seen so many procedurals that we're like, oh, objection.
I think it's that. I think it's the seeing so many procedurals. And I also think, like, if you put yourself in those character shoes, especially like the jury, I mean, it's the 40s. You've got this lawyer swinging a gun around. They're not really thinking about logistics and stuff. If you hear about a guy, you know, who his wife's, you know, sleeping around him, so he kills them both. I mean, that's so much mounting evidence and just, you know, coincidence at levied against you. It's like, how do you fight back? How do you try to prove your innocence in that way? Like, it's incredibly difficult because there's just so much, you know, against you, and it's a tough, it's an uphill battle at that point. Especially when, like you said, he's waving around a gun that's like a replica of, because they don't have the one there. Like, that's just, it's even more damning.
That's right. He doesn't say this is exhibit number A or exhibit number whatever, or the bottom line is it can't be an exhibit because you have no proof. You know, you don't even know what type of gun was used. It's all supposition here. And you'd think that Andy would have been smart enough to get a better lawyer.
You'd think. But I think he's also just in the shock of everything, and just so, like, out of character and you know, unnerved by everything. I mean, even in his face, like, just looking so in shock and unblinking, and, you know, he's probably scared to an extent, and everything that's happening, just being like, well, what else is going to happen? Like, how else, you know, do I say anything? Am I going to somehow make it worse for myself if I do? Like,
right, well, Andy comes off as being very pompous in certain aspects. You know, someone who seems like a intellectual know-it-all for a whole bunch of different things throughout the movie. He uses it to his advantage, obviously, by giving financial advice. But he's always very sure of himself. So you'd think that he would have been sure of himself that he would be innocent because he didn't do it. And somehow, you know, the walls are caving in on him.
Maybe. And maybe this is like some, I don't want to say an act, or like maybe some kind of thing he's throwing on, that if he looks, you know, the way he does, if he looks kind of like that, scared and unsure about himself, then, you know, maybe the jury might take it easier on him, or the judge might take it easier on him, versus, you know, if he looks very sure of himself, like, that's not going to help himself out.
True. But you'd think also that he had enough money in order to hire a good lawyer. Apparently not. Because
maybe that's one thing he's not good at, is picking out lawyers.
apparently. Because you'd think that that a good lawyer would be objecting here to these type of things. I mean, I know it's the summation, and you don't have to necessarily object. I don't know if you're allowed to object during a summation. It doesn't matter that when this was brought up as evidence, because this can't be the first time that the DA is mentioning this idea of 8 bullets. In a six shooter, you know, it must have come up through the trial also, because this is a summation. So I don't know.
One would think.
Yeah, and then we get the credit on the screen of screenplay by Frank Darabont, which it always boggles me, the fact that you know, this was Darabont's first movie, and he does such an amazing job with it. And I mean, especially when we know about the other movies he does.
Yeah. And it's not like he's operating on any kind of pretense or something he's done before. And I think that's why everything just feels so fluid and constantly moving. There's not a lot of cuts. There's not a lot of, you know, crazy edits like we talked about in the previous episode here. Like, it's just, everything is just constantly moving. Like, the story is progressing, and you feel like you're on this ride, albeit a gentle ride at first, but you just feel like, you know, we're just moving along in the story.
Right. It's true. Also, I just re-looked it up, and this was not Darabont's first screenplay. It's his directorial debut. But he also wrote the screenplay for 5 episodes of the Indiana Jones Chronicles, 2 episodes of Tales from the Crypt. He wrote the screenplay for The Fly 2, The Blob, and A Nightmare on Elm Street 3, Dream Warriors, which I to me, that's the best Nightmare on Elm Street film. I've always loved that one. And I don't like horror, but I always found that one to be really fun. You know, the fact that you have all these kids who have powers to try and fight back against Freddy. So, yeah. But if you look at it, he pretty much stays in the realm of pseudo horror, or let's put it this way, pseudo horror or Stephen King. That's what it comes.
Yeah.
So he's Frank Darabont is pretty talented.
No, very much so.
Yeah. At this point, we see that Quentin then pulls up Andy Dufresne's wife's dress, and the two of them start getting
familiar with each other.
Yes, very familiar with one another. Even though I believe that they are familiar already, but they're getting more That's familiar true. Once again. How's that? That's right. And it's very interesting that they set this up, you know, with the I guess background narration of the DA. You know, where when he's talking about the fact that an extra bullet per lover right in the head, and that's when the two of them start, you know, getting more at it, for lack of a better phrase.
Yeah. Interesting juxtaposition, because here's this violent act that he's describing, and then here's this other act that's kind of taking place.
Exactly. And it's this, and both of these acts happen to the same people. You know, that's the thing. You know, again, the jury doesn't see the two of them getting hot and heavy. We see it. So I think it goes back to what we were talking about yesterday, that in some ways this is a ploy to make us sympathize with Glenn Quentin and Andy Dufresne's wife. You know, with the fact that they were murdered, and it must have been Andy. And, you know, because anyone who hasn't seen this movie, I mean, again, you're 7 minutes into the movie. You have no idea what's really going on. Yeah. And you say, okay, they're telling us that this guy, they're presuming that this guy is guilty. And the movie, I guess, is about a prison. So, okay, he's going to go to prison. And we're going to see what happens to him in prison for killing his wife. You know, that type of thing. And then the shot changes and we're in the courtroom. And we have the judge who says, you strike me as a particularly icy and remorseful man, Mr. Dufresne. It chills my blood just to look at you. By the power vested in me by the state of Maine, I hereby order you to serve 2 life sentences back to back, one for each of your victims. So be it. And he pounds the gavel. Now, I mean, we were talking earlier about the fact that maybe Andy is, you know, using certain facial ploys to make people sympathetic with him, but apparently the judge just thinks he's an icy and remorseful man. So that it didn't work with the judge.
No.
Yeah, you know, and they don't even mention the fact that it's the jury that made the decision. It just makes it sound as if, I mean, again, the judge is giving sentencing, but he already was found guilty, if that's the case, because he doesn't say I find you guilty. You know, what he's saying is, here, I'm going to, this is the sentence that I'm giving you. You know, that type of thing. So.
Yeah, they kind of push through the whole jury portion, you know, reading off a guilty verdict and things, and it's just straight to, here's the judge throwing the book at him.
So this is an actor named John Horton, who was born in 1937. He was in another Stephen King adaptation, Thinner, and he played a judge there too, which came out 2 years later. I guess someone really liked the work he did here as the judge. Hey,
must have. You know,
hey,
must
this
have.
Is a great Stephen King judge. Let's bring him back in Thinner. And he has 46 acting credits on IMDb. And at this point, you know, as he's talking, we get to see a little bit of the room that he's in. And if you look in the back, there, on, first of all, on the screen comes the producer credit for Nicky Marvin, who we talked about a little bit yesterday. And then you see in the background a whole bunch of portraits on the wall. Do you have any idea who those portraits are?
I assumed that they would be previous judges from that courtroom because that feels like a very that of that era thing to do.
That era meaning 1947, or that era meaning 1994?
Yeah. 47.
Okay. So first of all, this was the whole movie was filmed in Ohio, not in Maine, and this was a real courthouse in I believe it's called Wyandotte County, Ohio, and the pictures in the background are of former judges from Wyandotte County from years earlier. So,
Okay, so I
for
was kind
sure.
of right.
So the three that I was able to identify were Judge Allen Smalley, who was a judge in the late 1800s and was a highly influential local legal figure. When they were building this courthouse in 1899. Another one is Judge Robert Carey, who presided over the county's common pleas court during the early 1900s. And then the third one is Judge Richard Elmer Hare, H-A-R-E.
Elmer.
That's right. A judicial figure whose official portrait is part of the courthouse's historical collection, decorating the wood paneled walls. That's all it really tells us about them. But it's just really interesting that you know there's a whole bunch of different you know that these are they want you to believe that they're Maine judges, but they're really Ohio judges for the whole thing. The cast of people who played the jurors are all locals that one of the extras is a guy named Mike Knox, who apparently was put in the back row. And if you look carefully, you see that he constantly moves back and forth so that you can see his face, so that nobody would be blocking his face.
That's funny. Hey, I'm here
Exactly.
to
I
play.
want to be able to tell people.
Excuse
That's right.
me,
I want to be able
pardon
to tell
me.
people 32 years from now that I was in the Shawshank Redemption. And if you don't believe me, just look. I'm the I'm
Yeah,
that's right.
I'm the guy moving.
I'm juror number 10 moving around, you know, or whatever it is. There's also a deleted sequence scene.
I'm not Mr.
That's right.
Juror.
No, I'm Mr. Juror's wife, you know, or Miss Miss Juror's husband.
Yeah.
Juror number 8's husband, you know, that type of thing. Now apparently there's a deleted scene that showed the jury deliberating, and they were supposed to in this scene they were supposed to be eating lunch, and because Darabont kept ordering many continuous takes, the production staff had to keep telling the people to stop eating because they were eating the fried chicken that they brought too fast. And they were quickly running out of food, you know, for all the takes.
That's funny.
And apparently the chairs that you can see that the spectators are sitting on in the courtroom, they are known as hat trick chairs because they are chairs that were created at in you know around the turn of the century. They were built around the turn of the century when this courthouse was built, and at the time chairs would have a wire rack underneath them in order for people to be able to men to be able to store their top hats.
Pretty cool.
Years later, they that when they when they restored the courthouse. So what they decided to do is they put a time capsule inside the statue of the Lady Justice that contained a copy of the Shawshank Redemption. And a dedication to all the people from the town who participated in the filming.
That's pretty cool.
Yes.
I like that.
I agree. Hmm? That's right. So yeah, I like that little bit of information that they add here.
I'm curious as to what format it's on. If it's like a VHS or a DVD copy. And if it's still good or not.
Why, you see, that's interesting that you're asking that, because when I read it, my impression was is that it was the book that they put in there.
Oh, see, I immediately thought of the movie.
It just says a statue containing a copy of the Shawshank. So that's interesting. I'm assuming it was VHS, which means that in 100 years from now, when they open it up, no one will be able to watch it.
I wonder what this was. Oh, we can stream it now. Here, download it to your brain and just close your eyes. Yeah,
that's right. No, they'll look at it and they'll go, wait a second. I remember in Castaway, someone used this in order to wrap logs together for making a raft. That's what it is. It's extended tape, to put logs together. So interesting. As I said, we get the credit for the producer, Nicky Marvin, who is the sole producer who is given an Oscar nomination for this film, who she definitely I still think that this movie should have won, but whatever. I understand why it didn't at the time, but that's not the point. This was one of those movies that took a while for people to understand.
Yeah, which it's funny because I feel like a lot of times that's just how it happens. It's something comes out and it doesn't get the attention it deserves, and then I don't want to say by stroke of luck, but I think with this one it was like people catching it on like reruns on TV or something, and it finally getting that second life, if you will, and then people realize like, oh wow, we really kind of messed up on this one, and then getting back to it.
Right. It's true. That's true. And then the judge bangs his gavel. So what do you know about the instrument known as a gavel?
I know that people have them in meetings. I know they're banged a lot and people say order, order, or, quiet, hush, silence. I think it's just something to get people's attention. And I think it's because a lot of times, well, not a lot of times, but back then, it's not like everything was mic'd up and wired for sound. So you couldn't just talk into something and have somebody recording. And you have a lot of people in the room probably murmuring. So you get somebody's attention by banging on this gavel, like, all right, everybody hush. And then off they go. Similar to, why can't I think of it? At auctions, auctioneer. You know how they kind of bang something in and get everybody's attention, like, hey, boom, sold, and then upward and onward.
Right. Okay. That makes sense. It's not completely correct, but that's good.
I'll take a good starting point.
There you go. It's a good starting point to jump off from. So it's basically a ceremonial mallet that's used to demand attention, maintain order, or signal definitive rulings. And it originated from medieval English land courts and became very popular in the 18th century because of Masonic traditions. And now it is the iconic global symbol of institutional authority. Originally, in medieval times, when feudal tenants had to pay their rent for the lands, and they would pay with non-monetary items, like maybe grain or livestock or things like that. So the court official would have to strike a wooden hammer to signify that the debt was cleared.
Huh.
Yeah.
Okay.
So the design of the gavel that we use nowadays likely comes from the Stonemason's Maul, M-A-U-L, which was used to build medieval cathedrals, and the Freemasons adopted the mallet as an emblem of leadership power and the ability to build, or to the ability to control a meeting. Now, after the American Revolution, so many of the founding fathers were Masons, and they introduced the gavel into U.S. legislative bodies and courtrooms. And by the 1830s, the judges started using it in America to finalize decisions, and auctioneers began to use it to close bids. Do you think that there are places outside of the U.S. that use gavels?
I think they do, but I don't think it's in the same style that we use it or have it. You know what I mean? Like, instead of a hammer-based thing, it might be like, here's a shell, or here's a block, or a square, or some other kind of signaling device.
Wait, you mean like the three seashells? Do you know how to use the three seashells?
I don't think I do.
Okay. And everyone's just going to laugh at you in Demolition Man. Just
kidding. That's fine. I'm going to have to take it.
No, we all will just do what he does by just cursing to get a little bit of paper. yeah. So apparently, most people believe that in England they use them, because in movies they have them using gavels, but in British courtrooms they never use gavels. The judges either use verbal commands or have a ceremonial mace. My assumption is they're not talking about mace that you spray in someone's face.
I would assume as much, yes.
Exactly. In parliamentary procedure, the number of strikes carries specific instructions. Oh, one tap seats members or signifies adjournment. Two taps call a meeting to order, and three taps signal for all members to stand. The UN actually uses a gavel that they got from Iceland in 1952.
Huh.
And they use that for that. So yeah, that's an interesting little few tidbits about gavels.
I like it.
Yeah. And now I love the way that the camera moves here after the judge makes his judgment, because it just zooms in on Andy. And the one thing that you can notice right away is that his tie is not tied properly, meaning it doesn't reach the top. Like when you're in a formal setting, the tie is supposed to cover your button. I mean, it's supposed to go all the way to the top.
Mm.
And here it doesn't. So and it doesn't, it seems out of place for someone like Andy.
He was probably in a jail or prison being held, and they gave him some random clothes that maybe didn't fit properly, or he just didn't get something done right, or maybe he tugged a little too soon to give himself a little breathing room around the neck.
Okay, but again, I think that based on what we know of Andy, he's a very meticulous guy. So for him not to do this properly is it shows that he is completely thrown aback by this whole thing.
Yeah.
You know, he didn't expect to be convicted. Yeah, I think he was a little too high on himself, thinking that. And then he closes his eyes, and as he closes his eyes, as the gavel bangs, so the screen fades to black, which is also very cool.
Yeah.
Because it's as if it's his eyes that are no longer seeing something.
Yeah.
And then a few seconds later, the light comes back on, or we see something, and we see a gate, moving to the left. And then we see a window in the a small window in the distance with a face behind some grated window there. And we get the credit for Frank Darabont as the director. And then the door opens, and we see that we're in a room with five men that are sitting at a table, and there's a guard that opens the door, and someone is moving into this room, and then we see it is Red, Ellis Redding, who is basically Morgan Freeman, and he takes his hat off, which again, this movie, everyone's always taking their hats off everywhere they go. Yeah. which is really, really cool that they, the way that they show that to us. And then he, you see that he's nervous. The guard closes the door. And then he, as he's putting his hands behind his back to stand at attention, that's where this minute ends. So, Nick, did you have anything you want to add about this particular minute?
One thing I kind of liked, and I think it's in combination of the edit they make where Andy closes his eyes and then they cut to, you know, it's dark and we see the bars and being opened. And I feel like that combination of sounds like really works for that moment and like setting the tone, as well as like, okay, here's our transition. Now we're going from this over to this. I just like that a lot.
Yeah, I think it's very cool. And it's, you know, again, it's jumping between the two main characters. You know, what would you think? Who's the main character here if you have to choose between the two of them?
I think the main character is Morgan Freeman.
I agree with you 100%.
Yeah. I think Andy is just a player in the story.
That's right. Because Red is telling this story. He's the one giving us this tale. So I agree with you 100% on that. I think he is the main character. All right, so today's segment is called Talking Tuesday, where my guests will give their top five movies featuring narration or narrators in movies. So why don't you start with your number five and work your way up?
Starting with my number five, I have The Royal Tenenbaums. Number four, I have Brunson. Number three, Stranger Than Fiction. Number two, The Princess Bride. And number one, Goodfellas. Just that great opening line. All my life, all I wanted to do is be a gangster.
Ugh. That's right. That's right. It's interesting that you mentioned The Princess Bride. I never would think of it as something that's being narrated. But again, it is, you know.
Mm-hmm. It's being read to us.
That's right. That's right, because we're all thick Kevin Arnolds, you know.
yeah, we're all Fred Savage.
There you go. It's really weird looking at him at this point. You know, looking at him and you know, after 39 years, I was like, wow.
Yeah.
But it's still very interesting to see that. I like it. I like it. That's a great list. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
I'm always curious what people are going to choose over the course of the entire season. But since this is only the second week, I don't really have very much to compare it to.
Well, hopefully I've got some gems in there that you won't hear for several more episodes or for the rest of the show. Who knows?
Well, you know. Do you want them to be things that no one else chooses, or do you want them to be you know, other options that people do choose?
A little bit of both, I'm not going to lie. There's a part of me that wants to make sure that people know about these films, and then there's another part of me that's like, nah, keep it to myself. Let me be selfish a little bit. Keep it to myself.
Okay. There's nothing wrong with that. I didn't remember that Bronson is a movie that's with narration. I mean, I only saw it once, years and years ago. So.
I very much enjoy that movie. I've seen it a handful of times.
Okay. That is definitely fair. All right. Now we will play the first of two daily games. So we will now play High-Low, where my guest will give his guesses on IMDb ratings and Rotten Tomato ratings of some of the movies that have been nominated for Best Picture over the last 76 years. So let's spin the wheel and see what Nick gets for his first one. All right, your first one is Raging Bull. From 1980.
Okay. I think the IMDb score for this is going to be a 9, and the Rotten Tomato. No, yeah, I'm gonna stick with your gut. It's going to be a 9, and the Rotten Tomatoes is going to be a 92.
All right, once again, you're closer on the Rotten Tomatoes. It's 93, and it
Okay.
has an
Wow.
8.1 on the IMDb.
Okay. Okay, not as popular. All right.
All right, let's spin the wheel for your next one. Right, the 1966 movie, The Russians Are Coming, The Russians Are Coming.
Okay.
Have you ever seen that?
Don't know. I don't know this one at all. I don't think I've ever heard of this movie.
It's with Alan Arkin. It's a comedy with Alan Arkin from
And
1966.
it's from 66. Okay. Let's say I think a safe 7.3 for IMDb. And for Rotten Tomatoes, I think we're going to have to go a little bit low. Let's say 82%.
Bingo, it's 82%.
I had to get there eventually. It kept being off by one, so this had
That's
to
right.
be.
That's right. And how much did you say the IMDb was?
I think I said a 7.3 or 7.4, 7.3,
Okay,
7.3.
it's a seven.
Okay,
So
that's
you're good.
still within that safety range.
Yeah, for sure. For sure. And again, you this time you got the 82% right on the dot. Perfect.
Now time to whiff the next one.
There you go. Let's spin the wheel for your last one. Okay, the 1984 film A Passage to India, which was David Lean's final movie nominated for lots of Oscars.
Okay. You said this was 84?
Yes.
All right. I'm going to say the IMDb on this, maybe like a 8.3. And I'm going to say the Rotten Tomatoes, probably not as high as some of his other films. So let's say a 90% on Rotten Tomatoes.
No, you got both those wrong. So
Oh.
it's a 7.3
Okay.
with a 76% rating on Rotten Tomatoes. It
That's a
isn't
drop.
as successful as his other stuff. It was a it's a courtroom drama taking place in India.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. It's an interesting movie, and I know that David Lean got very upset at Hollywood and the Academy after that because he felt the movie was much more deserving of accolades, I guess. But again, that makes sense. Most people think that what they do is the best. And I'm not saying
Of course.
that in a bad way.
Well, no, but you got to have some of that confidence about the artwork you're putting out. If you put it out and they kind of, poo-pooed it, if you will, and you were like, yeah, you're right. Like, what does that say about, you and the product you're putting out?
Then maybe you're honest. I don't know.
There's that. That's one way to look at it.
Exactly. All right, let's spin the wheel for the second game that we're going to play today. Name that book adaptation. Okay, this is a movie from 2019.
Okay.
All right, and the name of the original novel that it is based on is Go Like Hell.
Okay. All right, so 2019. Go Like Hell. I'm trying to think back, I'm trying to use my pre-pandemic brain to figure out what was in theaters. Go Like Hell, so it's probably a racing movie.
Very good.
or some type of chase. I'm trying to think of a big racing one that was around. What's his face? The Christian Bale and why can't I think of his name? He's coming up in the Odyssey. Matt Damon.
Okay.
And they were Ford v Ferrari.
Very good. I'm so glad that you were able to work your way there without needing any hints.
This time.
true. But okay. You still did it. So that doesn't matter.
Right? I didn't realize that was based on a book.
Apparently it is. Apparently it is.
Huh.
All right. So, Nick, would you like to once again tell people where they can find Nick React?
Absolutely. You can find me over at the Rabbit Hole Podcast Network. And every so often, I show up over at the Exploding Helicopter Podcast, hosted by Will Slater. Recently, I've been on episodes where I discuss the film Wedlock, Half Past Dead, and Half Past Dead 2.
Sounds like fun.
And let me tell you, Half Past Dead 2 is something. It was awful. Spoilers. It was awful, but recording and talking to Will about it was pretty great. And regardless of the film, you should check those episodes out.
All right. Excellent. And finding me is very simple. Just do a quick search for Movie Around Minute. You can find me on Facebook. Find me on Twitter. You can find me on Instagram. You can find me on my website, moviearoundminute.com. And if you want to send me an email, you can send it to moviearoundminute@moviearound.net. So until tomorrow, get busy living.
Get busy dying.